Don't laugh.
Your financial status get in the way of hearing the Dharma. So we have books that we give away for free. We spend what excess money we can to get Buddhist books to give away. And you can find some by the bowl and by in the bookshelf in the back and in the boxes. That's about it. And if you can, of course, help out by putting your blankets away at the end, that would be great. So, been giving a series of talks on working with the Buddha's tips on working with the mind, or the tools that he gave us to work with obsessions and anxieties and fears and stuff like that. So this is one in a series of talks. Tonight's going to start out a little bit differently, in that the subject's going to seem unrelated to that, but then you'll see how it is related, so take my word for it. There's a great teaching where the Buddha is asked by a prince, Abhaya, what is the foundation for when you should say something and when you shouldn't say something? What are the rules for speaking? And there's this expectation that the Buddha is going to talk about whether speech should be pleasant or not. Because in the time of the Buddha, that was a very important concept. And it's a very important concept to us all. We all like to please the people we're talking with. People pleasing is certainly a human trait. Nobody likes to go around saying things that other people will find uncomfortable. But when the Buddha answers the question, he doesn't list saying things as being pleasant to the person you're talking to as one of the factors to bear in mind. He lists actually three factors. He says that before we say anything, we should ask ourselves, is it true? Is it beneficial? And is it the right time and place to say it? Again, is it true? Is it useful? And is it the right situation? So, in other words, the Buddha is saying that he would, given certain circumstances, say something that's unpleasant to someone. For example, you might know someone who is a alcoholic, and you want to have an intervention on them, and they might not want to hear that they've got a drinking problem. But still, it might be beneficial to tell them that. So, addressing someone, the issues to ask ourselves is not, is this something that the other person wants to hear necessarily? But is it beneficial? Is it true? And is it the right time to tell them? We could go through that very quickly. Obviously, the Buddha is suggesting that before we say something, that we evaluate it. And this is very much taking a teaching that he gave to his son and extrapolating on it. So he taught his son, Rahula, in the 64th Sutta. He said, before you think or say anything, ask yourself if it's harmful. So now he's adding on to it, and he's saying not only is it harmful, but ask, you know, is it beneficial? Is it the right time? And is it true? Now taking them one by one, true. The Buddha said he actually wouldn't teach anyone who was a habitual liar. That was actually one of his foundations of evaluating whether somebody was worthy of hearing the Dhamma. And the reason is because when we tell a lie, or when we think we have to get by lying, we're creating an entire version of reality that we have to keep in mind and memorize. and we're basically creating a lot of stress. And it's almost impossible to get to a peaceful mind state when we think the only way we can survive is by lying. A friend of mine was a student of a Buddhist monk, a monk I admire very much, and the monk gave him a test, and he said, suppose you were living in an oppressive authoritarian regime where criticizing the government could result in imprisonment, and you were hiding, a la Nazi Germany or Stalinist Russia, and you were hiding a friend who had criticized the government, and there's a knock on your door, and there is the secret police who have come to your house, and they're saying, are you hiding anyone who has criticized the government? What would you say? And my friend immediately said, well, I'd lie. And the monk said, well, that's not the correct answer. And my friend was somewhat startled. He said, well, would you have me say yes and have my friend who I've been concealing be taken away by the guards? And the monk said, no, that's not the right answer either. The correct answer is what the Buddha would do, which is the Buddha often answered questions that he didn't want to answer with other questions. So he would say, you would say, who, me? hiding people from you? Why would you think that? Anyway, so the idea of this is to get, and notice in this example that my friend just said the first thing that came to mind, which was the impulse to lie. But that if you think for a second, there's actually a lot of other solutions. But in life, when we're confronted with people, when people accuse us of something, when we feel under attack, when we're pushed up against the wall, our almost immediate impulse is to say whatever it takes to get out of that situation. We often don't take a moment to evaluate, well, what opportunities do I have here to practice creativity with the way I answer, but still answer truthfully. There's almost always another way, as that example shows you. So the truth is very much the foundation of one of the three foundations of what we say. The second is it beneficial? And this is really important because the Buddha listed in his other listings on right speech that idle chatter, where we're just talking to fill up silence, is a bad habit that we fall into, where we, you know, you're at a party and there's a silence that's fallen across the table and you find just like stuff coming out of your mouth and you have no idea why you're talking about it, but there's a sense of underlying physical discomfort at being with somebody when there's silence. So the Buddha talked about not falling into the trap of idle chatter, which generally, because it's so mindless and heedless and purposeless, we find that we often say some of our most unskillful things during these moments when we're just nervously talking. But on the other hand, there's this illusion that that means that the Buddha was really into silence. Actually, it's a very funny story. In today's Buddhism, virtually every sect of Buddhism, including Vipassana, they make a big deal about going to silent retreats. I'm sure you've all heard about silent retreats. I'm sure even some of you have gone on a silent retreat. I know I have. But frankly, there was a famous case in the suttas where a bunch of monks made a pact to spend the rains retreat in silence. They came to the Buddha at the end and they said, hey, Buddha guy, we just spent the retreat in silence. And the Buddha said, basically, congratulations, you just spent it like stupid cattle. You just spent your retreat like sheep. You have learned nothing, he said. Actually, silent retreats predate Buddhism. It actually goes back well past the beginnings of Brahmanism. It's a sectarian practice that came about before the Buddha. The Buddha went on to make it a rule that monks cannot spend the retreats in silence because He wanted them to practice something. What did he want them to practice? Right speech. You can't practice right speech if you're silent all the time. Right? So this idea that we somehow can find a solution by either A, in life, chattering mindlessly, or B, just saying absolutely nothing. Neither are the solution. As usual, the Buddha is saying there's a middle path. There's a third way. The point of retreats and the point of being heedful is to see what you're saying, and before and while we're saying it and after we're saying, ask ourselves, am I saying something that's useful? Am I saying something that's true? And is it the right time and place? Now, the right time and place is a really important factor to add in, because there's nothing more dangerous, especially in the hands of a spiritual practitioner, than being right. All of us, when we come about our spiritual practice, have the temptation to run around and tell our friends how they're causing themselves suffering, or how if they only meditated, they might not act so unskillfully, or whatever. It's certainly very tempting to me, and I will be the first to admit that I constantly fall into the trap. I'm a guy after all. I want to solve everybody's, problems. And it's always been a real learning curve for me over decades to allow people to suffer without needing to fix them. To notice when somebody wants to just have an ear, just wants to say, hey, I'm feeling really shitty today. I'm feeling really bummed out. And to not reply, well, the Buddha said blah, 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 blah. And I struggle with this all the time. But there's nothing that is more off-putting. I have, in my own personal experience, speaking and also listening to others, than having somebody tell you the truth when you don't want to hear it. Right? There's, when you just want to just complain, right? You just want to say how much you hate your job. There's nothing worse than somebody who says, well, why don't you get another job, right? Well, duh. But, you need the right to first vent a little. Now, on the other hand, there's a balance. If, on the other hand, you've been listening for a long time to somebody in the same shit, in the same I hate my job, the same I hate my mother, I hate my roommate, whatever, there comes a time to say, you know what? You're suffering an awful lot for this. Maybe you might want to consider making some changes in your life. We evaluate when's the right time. When are they most able to hear that? When can we find that one time where we can work with them? It's not a matter of just barging out with the truth or what we think is a solution, no matter what's going on, no matter if they're not ready to hear it. They might just need at that point to vent. So, those are the three foundations of speech, but the reason why this is so important to practice is because you can't practice any of these unless you apply these same factors to your own thinking. This is not supposed to be something that we just apply to the things we say. In other words, in order to speak in ways that are beneficial, we have to think in ways that are beneficial. In order to speak the truth, we have to learn to think true things. And in order to say the right things at the right time, we have to learn how to think the right things at the right time. That's why in the Buddha's Eightfold Path, before he gets to right speech, before that is right thinking. Or actually, right resolution, right resolve. So, this implies bringing a sense of mindfulness to what's going on in our minds. Starting to look at our thoughts in terms of these three foundations. Is what I'm about to think about, now what I mean by that is the first thought that pops into your head is not your responsibility. It's something you've probably heard, something that's been crammed into your brain by parents, by teachers, by friends, things you read. Most of the stuff that pops up in your head is stuff that you've internalized. There's very few thoughts that we've ever had that are wholly unique. It's sort of like when we choose something and then it becomes us. Our thoughts are things that we've heard, internalized, and then they're suddenly popping up in our heads. But we, when they pop up, we think, oh, that's my thought. It's not your thought. It's simply a thought that has been floating around there. If you don't believe me, you can take a few months and read the books of Foucault or Derrida, and they will explain much more eloquently than I why all your thoughts are not your own. Just take my word for it. What's going on in there is not something you've wholly created out of mind particles. It's stuff that you've internalized. So it pops up, and there's this tendency to think, oh, that voice that pops up in my head that tells me that that my boss doesn't like me. I should really explore this thought and go and run with it. Examine all the little things that my boss says. Really run with the idea that I'm unpopular at work. Now, so we have this voice that's popped up in our heads. We're not responsible for the fact that it's popped up, but we are responsible whether or not we listen to it, whether we run with it, whether we give it an audience, or whether we decide that this voice is not worth our time. So let's use that example. Is this voice, the voice that's telling me that my boss hates me and wants to fire me, given the first excuse, is this a true voice? Well, possibly. It's possibly true, but there's no way, if we don't know it as a fact, there's generally a lot of guessing going on. Is this a beneficial thought? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Going around worrying about your boss and thinking, trying to read your boss's mind, total waste of time. You can't suddenly totally change who you are. You can't suddenly grow skills that you didn't have before. If you're in for it, you're in for it. Trust me. And is it the right time or place to think that thought? Most of the time, not. Right? There's almost always something more valuable going on in your life than worrying about what somebody thinks about you. Because you can't read their mind anyway. And even if you could read their mind might change. I actually had a boss that one day would be in an incredibly bad mood, the next day would be in a terrific mood. And I went this was back in my 20s, and I went one day to the next for months thinking, oh, she likes me, she doesn't like me, she likes me. It was nuts driving. After a while, I realized that the way whatever she felt about me was changing all the time. So it was a waste of time to try to figure out what she was thinking about me. And that's basically the truth about figuring out what anybody's thinking about you. It's a waste of time. So asking ourselves these questions when a thought comes up in our head is an extremely valuable experience. Which brings me to another great example of where people's expectations of what the Buddha taught is far from the truth. Not only is it not in the Buddhist tradition to have silent retreats, but the Buddha didn't view meditation as a time where you magically got rid of all your thoughts. A lot of people sit in meditation and they come to me and they're like, oh, you know, I know meditation is a good idea, but I can't do it. I'm like, oh, really? Why? He's like, well, because my mind likes to think all the time. Frankly, the point of meditation is not to, at first, get rid of all your thinking. It's learning how to think thoughts that don't cause stress. And in order to do that, you have to practice. Just like the way we practice right speech, we practice thoughts that don't drive ourselves crazy. we practice focusing and watering thoughts that are beneficial. Thoughts that are beneficial are generally about what am I doing right now that will be helpful in the long term. Thoughts that are true, not getting caught up in fantasies about what might happen or worries or endless speculation, the Buddha called it, but focusing on what we know is going on right here and now. What can we work with? And of course, thoughts that are appropriate in the right time. Now, how do you do this? This is like a big question, right? How do you begin to work with your thoughts? The Buddha listed a couple really invaluable tools to work with our thoughts. The first is to set a set of ground rules, a set of conversational rules in your head, that if a voice breaks those rules, you're not going to listen to that voice. The voice cannot be insulting. It cannot be a voice that repeats itself endlessly over and over and over again. And it can't be a voice that shouts or just completely takes over the mind. Basically, you're saying that you want your thoughts to follow a sense of the same kind of rules that you would expect from somebody else talking to you or you would say to somebody else. You don't want thoughts that are obsessive, that are endlessly repeating themselves, that are just bombarding you. At first, this is very difficult because there's a tendency to think that the thoughts that repeat themselves the most are the ones that are the most important. I hate to break this to you, but that's generally the opposite of the case. I've found in my many years of being on this planet, too many dimensions, that the thoughts I have that are sometimes the best ideas only tell me themselves once, and generally very fleetingly. Like, oh, wouldn't it be a good idea to apologize for that remark? That's a thought I will only think once, and it will be a very quiet little fleeting, timid little voice that will be drowned out with the endless voices of self-justification for why it was totally fine for me to be short-tempered with someone or what have you. Those voices, the ones that repeat themselves loudly, are almost invariably the voices of fear, self-justification, and they generally don't lead us anywhere good. But just like the far right-wing pundits you see on debates, on talk shows, the people that are generally screaming and interrupting and yelling are generally the people that have the craziest view. And they're terrified that you will examine them or look at another possibility. So they'll tell you that you're unpatriotic, that you're insane, that you're crazy unless you do exactly what they say. I'll give you a great example. I've used this example, but it's a perfect example of how truly insane I can be. For a long time, I had a job where I was terrified of asking for a vacation. And when I analyzed why I was afraid of asking for a vacation, I unpacked that thought and I saw what was inside the thought, which was, I thought if I asked for a vacation, my boss would notice how little I worked. That she would decide to fire me, and because I was a fraud, according to my head, I would never get another job, which meant I wouldn't be able to pay my rent, which of course meant I would be homeless on the street, where I would then be killed by roving gangs of knife-wielding youth. So, asking for a vacation was a life-threatening endeavor. I was taking my life into my hands by asking for a few days off. Of course, when you see this, it's ludicrous, right? It's ludicrous. But it's important to notice, to stop, notice, stand outside of the thought, and see what's inside it. That brings me to my second part, which is unpack the thought. Unpack the thought. See what's really inside a thought. Don't take a thought like, oh, it's a bad idea to ask for a vacation, to be simply a bad idea on face value. Ask yourself why. Why should I follow this thought? Why is it a good idea to think about whether my boss likes me or whether they're going to... Why should I wonder if I'm going to get fired from my job or not? Is that really a good idea? Is that really something that's going to bring me wisdom? Is that something that right now is going to help me out? So another tool that's extremely helpful is to learn to stand outside of thoughts and to look at them. You can't really analyze them if you're inside them, if you've taken them on. The way you do that is by keeping part of your awareness on keeping your body relaxed. Whenever a thought comes into your head that announces yourself as something that's essential to be picked over and worked with, it's always a good idea to take a quick scan of the body and notice if suddenly everything in your body has gotten tight. That's a good tip that what you're about to think is not going to be particularly helpful, that it's shrouded in fear. But also just keeping part of your awareness on your body keeps you from falling into that thought entirely. The more we fall into a thought, the smaller the mind becomes, the more trapped we are by the obsession. So keeping the body relaxed is an extremely valuable tool. Another valuable tool is to begin to notice where thoughts come from. When a thought comes from that place in your body that you carry your fears, I carry them in my shoulders. To have that awareness of your body is that part of me that gets tense when I'm freaked out. Is it tight right now? I notice that whenever I have my stomach goes incredibly tight and my shoulders go like this, whatever my brain's about to announce is generally going to be fear, suspicion, doubt, dismay. It's going to be something that's immediately not going to have anything to do with what I'm doing right now. It's going to be a projection about how bad my future is going to be or how I don't compare very well with other people. Whatever. So that's a good technique. Another great technique that the Buddha also mentioned is to remind yourself that no matter what you thought, you're not the only one who's ever thought that way. He taught that to Kisa Gotami when she experienced the death of her child. He brought her to other people that were suffering and showed her that her grief, while very real, she wasn't the only person that had experienced grief. The moment we stop thinking that, oh, I'm the only one who's ever felt or thought this way, it transforms our relationship with what's going on inside. Finally, another really good tool is to give the voice a name so you don't mistake that voice for you. For instance, whenever I have a voice that's obsessively repeating itself, I almost invariably say, oh, here comes my fear again, or here is worry, here's the voice of what a failure I am, whatever. Have a name for it. Just naming a voice that arises in your head keeps you from that cardinal mistake of believing that that voice is who you are. That voice is me. And once we don't fall into that trap of mistaking a voice in our head for us, then we can analyze it and we can begin to decide whether a thought or a voice is something that we should run with, or whether it's actually a voice that has always gotten us into trouble. You'll begin to notice which thoughts are the ones that always have you running around in circles, which are the thoughts that always have you freaked out, and which are the thoughts that bring you calm. The thoughts, I'll give you a hint, the thoughts that bring you calm are thoughts of appreciating the skillful things you've done, the skillful things that other people have done, giving a sense of there's not something missing from your life, but a sense of appreciation for what is in your life. That sense of fullness almost invariably quiets the mind. Thoughts that are about letting go of that one thing that we think will solve everything for us. Because the mind has this tendency to fixate on that one thing. Oh, if only I get a girlfriend, a boyfriend, a better apartment, if only I get a better job, if only I get that one thing. Sometimes if we just let that go and just say, how can I embrace my life exactly as it is? Even without that one thing that I think will solve it all for me, that brings on such a sense of relief. I actually have one person who I remember talking with who had this endless debate in his head about whether a woman liked him or not. With men, there's a thing called over-sexual perception. In case you don't know what that is, there's actually a psychological term, over-sexual perception. Men tend to believe that women are more into them than they actually are. This will come as a stunning surprise to you all. Over-sexual perception. This guy had it really bad. And he was absolutely incapable of actually asking the woman if there was mutual attraction or not. So I simply said, well, what would it be like if you just decided that you didn't and let it go? What happens then? And there was this moment of just great relief. You know, he could just like move on with his life. I said, you know, the better thing to do would be just to tell her and ask her. But if you can't do that, why not just let it go? Right? Just let it go. Just if you have a voice that's arguing with you in your head, instead of, you know, arguing with it, just give up. Okay, I'm going to lose my job. Fine. Okay, I'm going to be dumped. Okay, this girl doesn't like me. Okay, I'm not going to get what I want from my art. Okay, blah, blah, blah. Just let it all go. See what happens. You'll find that you can actually live. And you'll find that you'll still do your art. You'll still probably get laid. You'll still have a job. But all that worrying about whether you're going to get more will have been taken away. And that, the Buddha said, is one of the greatest keys to relieving ourselves from stress and suffering. So that's how right speech leads to right thinking. You can't have one without the other. If you want to have any one practice to start calming your thoughts, practicing this is as good as any. I'll be giving other tools as I have for the previous weeks, in the weeks to come, of the various different tools that the Buddha said brought us relief from the suffering that our thoughts bring us. So thanks for listening, and now is your time to ask any questions or share any comments that you like. Thanks. Hi.
I have a question that's not directly related to this, but it's kind of, I think, about sleep. I'm wondering if you can give any skillful ways of prepping